Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. If you know someone who might be interested in the show, like science, drop them a link. We'd really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be following the extraordinary migration journeys of some of our world's most extraordinary creatures with the brilliant Dr. Lucy Hawkes. Before we get into news round, just to let you know that if you are, like me, enthusiastic about AI but don't know how to get started with it, I've started a new program. It's called Get Started with AI, and we have two events coming up. One is for academics and researchers. It's online at the end of this month. And then we also have an in-person bootcamp in Dublin for SME owners. We'll be fixing your problems right there in the room. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, getstartedai.com is the website where you can find out more. If you'd like to get in touch with the program generally, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. It's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Lara Dungan, immunologist and medic. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Lara, has to do with the menstrual cycle.
It does. This was just published in Nature, and it's really, really exciting. And I think it's such a practical study. So back in 2016, there was a researcher called Kalinda Scheel, and she was working in the Catholic University in Leuven, which is in Belgium. And she was studying how chemotherapy affected breast cancer cells. And she noticed that there was a lot of inconsistencies in what should have been consistent cell lines that were coming from mice. And she started to wonder why. And this led to a great deal of research that went on to consider whether or not the menstrual cycle in mice, which isn't called the menstrual cycle, but it's the equivalent, is if affecting how our breast cancer cells would respond to chemotherapy.
Sorry, just a quick pause. What is the menstrual cycle in mice called?
It's called the estrus cycle, and it's 4 or 5 days long, and they don't menstruate. So that's why it's not called a menstruation cycle, because they don't menstruate. But they do have, like humans have, fertile and non-fertile periods. It just happens much more rapidly without menstruation. And if you think about it logically, this actually makes a huge amount of sense. So when we are fertile, which is when we have low progesterone in that part of our menstrual cycle, our breast tissue or our mammary gland cells are actually rapidly proliferating, and they're getting ready to essentially have to feed a baby or to have a pregnancy. And chemotherapy targets rapidly dividing and proliferating cells. So there's already kind of a logical leap where you think, God, this is really, really clever. So they treated mice in this low progesterone or fertile phase with chemotherapy, mice that had obviously been given breast cancer. And they found that they responded much better to the chemotherapy when the chemotherapy was started in this low progesterone or fertile phase. Now, they didn't move on to doing this in humans yet, but what they did do, which I think is really interesting, is they looked back, did a retrospective review. So they had 17 women who had received chemotherapy for the first dose. Now, because remember, a lot of time chemotherapy will actually stop your menstrual cycle. So the most relevant time is the very first dose. So they had 17 women who received chemotherapy during the fertile phase of their menstrual cycle, and they had 13 women who received it during the non-fertile phase. They knew this because they went back and looked at the progesterone levels in the serum. And what they found was the women who had received it in this fertile low progesterone phase actually had less disease progression and reduced tumor burden. Now, this is only a retrospective study, but in something that is almost negligible in terms of, do I start the chemotherapy now or in 2 weeks' time or one week time, depending on the menstrual cycle, it could have profound impacts. And it really is just one of the simplest ways I can possibly think of to maybe treat breast cancer better and more rapidly without doing any harm to a patient. So I think it's really interesting.
I have a question, and that is, why have we not picked up something like this before? I mean, when a patient goes into a cancer trial or cancer treatment, there's so much information that is recorded, right? Surely someone has looked back at all of these patterns and gone, well, this person was having their period and they did well or they didn't, and this person didn't. Maybe there's some patterns here. Like, this seems like something that really should have just been popping out of the data. But I'm looking at both Ruth and Lara's faces now, and you're both shaking your head and smiling.
Do you know what it is, Johnny? And I think it's terrible because you're asking a feminist. And a lot of the time, women's health does not come into research and people don't include these kind of things. And it seems so logical. We know that breast tissue proliferates in this part of the cycle. This is not new. This is not news. Why no one has taken the cognitive leap beforehand, I have no idea. The feminist in me wants to argue because we're women, but that's probably not fair. I mean, there has to be a time where everything is discovered. I just wish it had been many years ago, if it is able to help women. And sorry, men. Men can also get breast cancer, so I don't mean to exclude any men that have had breast cancer.
Very kind of you. I was going to ask you about the cyclical cycles that we have, because we talked about this a few years ago, I think, Lara, about, you know, our sleep cycle. What's it called? The
circadian rhythm.
Circadian rhythm. Thank you. And how that can affect treatment. Has that progressed at all? When you're talking about treating someone, do you take into account their circadian rhythm?
Definitely not for chemotherapy. I mean, obviously the circadian rhythm is a 24-hour cycle, and it's on our immediate 24-hour, we are grossly controlled by the circadian rhythm. And then we have a lot of other hormonal cycles that happen over longer periods of time. But in terms of the circadian rhythm, we don't give chemotherapy in the morning or in the evening or anything based on cortisol levels. It's not practical and it's not done currently. I'm not saying that, you know, watch this space.
Very good. Ruth, our second story is just one of those stories you don't want to read in the morning, which is when I read it, which is about eating from plastic.
Eating from plastic and takeaway containers and things you might have enjoyed last night as you relaxed on the couch. This is research that was published in Ecotoxicology and Environmental Safety from researchers in two Chinese universities. And they were interested in looking, as you say, at the link, whether there are any links between eating your food out of plastic containers and negative impacts on your health. So they did two different parts of their research study. The first part was done on a questionnaire, and they surveyed over 3,000 people in China, and they asked them how frequently they ate their food out of plastic containers and what kind of plastic containers they used. And then they asked them whether they had anything like high blood pressure, coronary heart disease, any arrhythmias, any congestive heart failure. And what they found was a very strong, significant correlation between those that had a higher frequency of eating their food out of plastic and these heart conditions. Now, obviously, that is a correlation, not a causation. You know, maybe these people were eating a lot of highly processed food as well, et cetera, et cetera. But they did go on then to do a second part of the study, which is when they looked at rats, and they had three different groups of rats, and they gave them water that had been boiled and left sitting in plastic containers for different time periods. So they had kind of 1 minute, 5 minutes of boiling water, 15 minutes of boiling water. And they gave the rats this water as their exclusive source of drinking water for 3 months. And after 3 months, they took fecal samples from the rats, and they also euthanized them and had a look at what was going on inside their bodies. And what they found was, in all cases, the rats had significantly altered the microbiome in their gut compared to rats that hadn't been fed the water that had been heated in plastic. And they also found, when they looked at the gut, there was inflammatory cells that had penetrated into the gut. They found changes to the mitochondria, and they also found oxidative stress and inflammatory markers in the hearts of these rats.
So, I mean, that all sounds quite dramatic, right? But lots of us have been eating from takeout containers for quite some time. We haven't seen an enormous wave of health. Or is this something that we hadn't realized may have a severe impact on human health and is responsible for some of the waves of inflammation and other diseases that we see?
We're only kind of at the tip of the iceberg of understanding this when you think for how long humans have been eating this way. And actually, there was a study published in Nature Medicine last week, which said that on average at the moment, every human brain that has been autopsied has about a teaspoon of microplastics in it. And that concentration has gone up by 50% in just the last 8 years. So this is not a very fast growing problem. And of course, what's happening in the brain, because most of the brain is made up of fat. I mean, that's why we think about omega-3s and things being good for your brain. But also the particles of plastic that are ending up in the brain are the very, very tiniest particles. Some of them are only the size of like two COVID viruses. So that can get inside individual cells. And we are seeing in some studies higher instances of these plastic sort of pieces in brains of people with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Again, this is correlative. It's not proven as causative, because we know that dementia and things, you would see potentially changes in the brain. So, I mean, look, I think all of these studies are a warning call. We can just keep going down this path, or we can think about doing something about it.
Yeah. I mean, like at the very least, you know, don't be eating out of the food containers, but also don't be heating food in the plastic thing in the microwave. Just don't do that. Right. Lara, our third story was quite an interesting one, and it has to do with why we scratch an itch.
Yeah, so this came from Daniel Kaplan's research team over in the University of Pittsburgh, and it was published in Science. So, Johnny, what would you do if you put your hand into a pot of boiling water?
I would scream.
What would you do with your hand? You'd take it out. So we know that scratching damages our skin. Everybody knows that you get a bite and everyone says, don't scratch it, don't scratch it, don't scratch it. So if we know that something is damaging, why is it that we don't get a response to tell us to avoid it? So a trigger avoidance response. In fact, we actually get a pleasurable response when we scratch, but we know it's damaging. So the question is why, and what they found in this research that is really, really interesting, very, very long paper, but I'm going to summarize it, is that there are actually benefits to scratching. It was a very long paper, but to summarize it, essentially we know that our skin has got mast cells, which are cells from the immune system, and they are important for fighting some infections. And what this team did is they generated mice that were deficient in a neuron that senses itch. So these mice didn't get itchy, so therefore they didn't scratch. And they found that from using these mice and normal mice, that when you scratch, you release a substance called substance P. And that actually activates mast cells to produce inflammatory mediators. So by scratching, you cause your immune cells to actually produce things that cause inflammation and that can actually help fight infection. They confirmed this then by generating mice that didn't have substance P, so that they would scratch, they would feel the need to scratch, but the scratch would do nothing. They wouldn't create the inflammation, it wouldn't help to reduce the infection, and it wouldn't help to prevent them from having any issues with bacterial infection. And they looked to see about scratching. So they found that scratching reduced the microbial diversity on the skin, and that in a bacterial infection, that scratching helped to increase inflammation and the defense required. So scratching does have a good function, but over-scratching is where you reach the problem.
Should we be scratching with like a ruler from what you just said?
Absolutely. Just ideally, just minimal scratching with clean hands. But, you know, really, that's not like, I think overarchingly the message is don't scratch. But I think you're going to do more damage than good. But there's a certain amount of scratching that will help you.
Oh, now it's making me feel very itchy. Let's wrap this up with our final story, Ruth, which has to do with birds of paradise.
And talk while I'm squirming now here. Birds of paradise, and we all know they are pretty spectacular. They're kind of known for their amazing feathers, the long feathers, the colour, but actually they are even more amazing than we knew. And this is research that was done at the American Museum of Natural History. And what researchers did is they went back, they have specimens of many of the different species of birds of paradise. And they went back and looked at 45 different species. And they looked at all different parts of their feathers and their bodies under different kinds of light. And when they looked at them under UV light, they found that actually parts of their body and their feathers display biofluorescence. And biofluorescence is a phenomenon when an organism can absorb sunlight and or UV light, any kind of light, and transform it and emit it as another form of light. So usually it's emitted at a lower wavelength light, like red or orange. And what they found was of the 45 birds of paradise that they looked at, 37 of them actually have the ability to create biofluorescence. And this could be on their head, their chest, their belly. And they found often it was in feathers that were, you know, a brightly colored feather that was beside a dark feather. So you can imagine when this is glowing as they're doing their dance at dusk in the forest, they look absolutely spectacular. And so it's another way that they're completely incredible.
I remember this story about the Natural History Museum going through all of these different species and discovering that almost all of them gave off some sort of luminescence. And then there was a question about whether or not someone had just been not very careful with a substance and accidentally wiped these animals, because it seemed to be everywhere. This doesn't surprise me. I think if you put pretty much any animal under one of these lights, you might be surprised at what you find.
Yeah, well, they are not alone. So we know, for example, that puffins' beaks glow pink and white under UV light. Budgies and owls, their faces glow under UV light. Platypuses, wombats, lots of monitors. some plants, and actually finches, there's species of finches, when they're in the nest and they open their beaks, they essentially have fluorescent landing strips around their mouth so that when their parents are coming back with food in poor light, they can get the food straight into their mouths. But I think this study, it's so cool. And I think this study just reminds us that our perception of the natural world is very much only one perception. There's all sorts of other things, other smells, other sounds, other things that are visible in other ways. We only see kind of maybe one or two dimensions of it. So we should stay humble as we look at the natural world.
Really, really cool. Dr. Ruth Freeman and Dr. Lauren Dungan, thank you so much. Now, my next guest is a species migration expert who's dedicated her life to tracking what she calls animal athletes and their fascinating journeys, such as basking sharks, bar-headed geese, and sea turtles. Dr. Lucy Hawkes gave her National Geographic's Explorer talk at the Northern Ireland Science Festival yesterday, and she now joins me to talk about her work. Lucy, it's great to have you on the program. I have to say, I love talking about migration because there's so much to talk about from so many different species, but the distances and how some of these animals travel around the world, it's such an endlessly giving subject, isn't it?
I know. And thank you so much for having me on. And yes, I love talking about it too. And it fascinates me so much. The more I find out about how these amazing animals travel around the planet, the more I discover there is that we don't know, but the more wonder it kind of inspires in me, really. So I'm completely addicted to discovering my, to me, the essence of exploration is discovering something that no one else really knew before. It used to be a mountain. It used to be, you know, a new country. Today, it's discovering a secret about an animal that sometimes might be one that you see around you all the time, but actually travels somewhere far flung and exciting in some thrilling way.
Yeah. So let's talk about the obvious one, which is birds. I had no idea until I started reading up on this, the transformation birds undergo in such a short amount of time to travel the distance they travel. And the distances they travel is extraordinary.
It really is extraordinary. So there's a couple of sort of, all birds are amazing. Actually, the more I understand about birds, the more I think they might be magic because they are incredible. Their bodies are unlike mammal bodies and they do really amazing stuff. But some extreme examples are a bird called a bar-tailed godwit. And we do get these around the UK, but there are some in the Pacific that fly from New Zealand all the way to Alaska. And they make this flight in a week. They don't stop at all during this flight to eat, to drink, to sleep, nothing. And they literally consume half of their entire body during this journey. By the end, they're actually eating themselves to actually fuel this journey. It's quite extraordinary. But they're not even the most extreme ones. The most extreme ones are called Arctic terns. And these are small white seabirds that live all around the Arctic. But actually, they make a habit of traveling across the entire planet every year. And an individual Arctic tern will probably travel more than 100,000 kilometers over the course of a year, which is just mind-boggling.
So how do they do that? I mean, how does someone travel from New Zealand for that length of time, for a week, without requiring food or water or stopping? And how do you know they don't stop?
Well, we know they don't stop because we use electronic tracking tags. And
of course,
this is kind of the main thing that I do in my research career. And so we're able to see how high they're flying, how fast they're flying, and how many hours of the day they spend flapping sometimes as well. But one of the reasons they're able to do it is just by pure virtue of being a bird. So I think one thing I'd love to leave your listeners with is that every bird, be it a mallard you see down the park or a pigeon near the train station, they all have these amazing bodies that have been really finely tuned to allow them to use energy really efficiently. And if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be able to fly at all. Because the thing about flying is that while you might think running's hard work, flying's like 10 times harder. It's a really, really energetically expensive thing to do. So all of these birds are just incredible athletes just by virtue of being a bird at all, really.
Can you give me an example of some of the adaptations that are required to do journeys like that? Because they must breathe, they must fly, they must consume energy in a totally different way to humans.
They do. And you know what? I could talk for hours about this, but the biggest one, this one will blow your mind. So, you know, like when you breathe air into your lungs and then you breathe it back out again in the opposite direction. Birds don't do that. Birds' lungs only go one way. So birds' lungs are actually relatively small. They're actually relatively rigid, a little bit like a crunchy bar. And actually, instead, most of their body is made up of these things called air sacs, which are inflatable sacs of air. And when the bird breathes in, it goes, the air that it breathes in goes straight to the back of the bird. Half of it fills up air sacs and the other half of it goes into the lung. And then as the bird breathes out, the air in the lung goes out the mouth, but then the air in the air sacs travels into the lung. So every time they look like they're breathing in or out, they're actually always breathing in effectively. And being able to get that much oxygen into your body makes you able to do so many more amazing things, because oxygen in the end is the fuel of life.
When we talk about migration, people obviously they think of the Serengeti and they think of birds, but actually the journeys that insects make are, I would imagine, almost more impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we don't tend to think, exactly as you say, we don't think of insects as being any of the world's greatest migrators, but there are species of butterflies that can travel from North America down into Mexico. But more than that, they're probably traveling along, possibly even en route, feeding along with other insects as well. There are dragonflies that can make migrations across the entire Indian Ocean. And our leading hypothesis is that they're doing that while feasting on mosquitoes that are making the same journey with them. One study that was done in the southeast of England put a radar on the ground, and the radar just beams up energy that gets sent back to it if anything's in the way, like a raindrop or a butterfly or a mosquito. And they recorded something like in excess of 3 tons of insects flying through the skies above this part of southeast England. So there's an enormous amount of animal energy up in the skies above us all the time. It's quite mind-boggling.
Wow. Yeah, when you think of insects, or particularly butterflies, you know, you think of butterflies as being so delicate and so tiny, and the effort to move around so huge. You really don't think that they would be going very far, but some of these butterflies travel for 1,000 miles.
It's quite extraordinary. And they put lots of weight on before they migrate as well. So butterflies can get themselves really nice and chubby and fat. So they can switch the type of food they're eating so they can put loads and loads of fat down. So then if you're a migrating bird and you're going along and you suddenly see a bunch of migrating, you know, plant hoppers or mosquitoes or whatever, they're like fantastic little fat-filled snacks. They're like baby bells of the sky. So it must be fantastic as a bird to come across them and be like, everyone's migrating and these guys are like going to be the most brilliant snack ever.
Baby bells of the sky is something that we'll be able to imagine. Why do they do this? Now, I mean, I know there's obviously, you know, adaptations and lots of different reasons that at the time probably made sense, and then generationally they've just continued to do it. But if you think about the available food that is now along the path because of human just sprawl, it doesn't make sense, a lot of it. Why do all of these animals continue to migrate when there's garbage on everyone's back step?
Principally, animals migrate for kind of 2 reasons. One is to get access to breeding sites. So it could be that there just isn't anywhere decent to breed wherever it is you're spending the winter time. And then secondly, to get access to kind of better, safer places to live. You generally tend to get fewer predators as you move towards the poles. But also, when you get springtime occurring, as hopefully is going to happen soon, I'm so excited about spring, but the first flushes of spring grass are really protein rich. They're excellent grass to eat if you're a herbivore. And obviously, everything's turning up. And then you get these food systems that cascade down from that. But so you'd be turning up to the best bit of the buffet if you can get as far north or south as possible. But you're quite right. Things are changing. And us scientists like me that are tracking animals using electronic tags are suddenly finding animals that maybe don't go where we think they should, or sometimes part of the population migrates and the other part doesn't, or sometimes they take a much longer route to get somewhere than we might expect them to. And I'm a runner, but I'm also pretty lazy, so I'd rather save energy wherever I can. And so sometimes I'm looking at a sea turtle and thinking, why would you go that far when you could have just instead like avoided that and gone a much quicker way? So it's endlessly fascinating trying to understand why.
I haven't heard that many stories of species, you know, starting colonies in more convenient places. You know, the adaptation to say, you know what, maybe we don't need to go to the Arctic because there is a relatively safe place with food on the way much closer. That doesn't seem to happen. And I'm wondering how hard-coded these migration patterns are into the genes of these animals, that they literally just can't disobey what is in their very DNA.
Yeah, and there are examples of this, of animals doing what we call short stopping. So they don't make the entire migration and they stop short. So we're seeing this in some seabirds, for example. But equally, it is fascinating how some species are super hardwired for where they need to go. So I mentioned about Arctic terns earlier, these fantastically long distance migrating birds. I was studying them for some years in Iceland, and we would go to Iceland one year and I'd catch a bird and I'd put like an identifying number on its leg. And the next year I would go back and exactly the same tussock of grass would be exactly where that bird would be the next year. They have their absolute favorite places they go. And that seems to be very hardwired into them. And I find that almost kind of more interesting because these birds have surveyed the whole planet since they've been gone. And I was like, you didn't find anywhere better? Like, this is it, this tussock of grass? And I'm like, maybe I'm not seeing this grass the way I should.
It's like the families that go to the same resort in Portugal every single year. You talked about the trackers, and I'm wondering how good this technology has gotten. I was lucky enough to travel to French Guiana just the right time to place some trackers on the backs of some leatherback turtles as they were laying their eggs, and it was awesome.
Whoa!
One of the things I was told at the time is that this epoxy glue is good, but when it gets into the water, after a short amount of time, you've lost it, and that's it. You don't know where this animal goes. How long can we track these animals? What sort of technology are we using? And are we learning brand new things because technology's gotten better?
Yes to all of these things, but this is where science, people tend to think of science as being this kind of, nerdy black and white thing, but actually this is a bit of science that requires loads of creativity. First of all, catching wild animals can be really hard. I have been beaten down by so many different wild animals that I just couldn't get quick enough to catch, or just couldn't work out what wasn't going to freak them out.
Like what?
Well, like bar-headed geese that you mentioned. I've been studying them on the plains of Mongolia. And for about 3 weeks of the summertime, they actually molt the bottom half of their wing. They can't fly at all for about 3 weeks. And that's because feathers get worn down a bit like the tires on your car and they need to be replaced. So for about 3 weeks, they can't fly. And we're like, brilliant, we're going to go catch them. But oh my God, it was so difficult. They can run really fast. They can dive underwater for ages. Oh, we had these terrible kayaks that wouldn't go very fast. And oh, it took us like 2.5 years to work out how to catch them. And then when you do catch them, then you're like, okay, I need to get a tag that's going to be small enough to not bother this animal too much. Then I need to work out how to put it onto it. And people have put tags on various different animals that will take them off. So sometimes if you put a tag on a seabird, it will just take it straight off again because they don't like having anything stuck on the outside of them. They need their feathers to be waterproof and all the rest of it. So trying to work out whether it's glue, whether it's tying it on, whether it's bolting it on, which you can do on a shark fin, for example. And you have to find all these different ways of doing it and then work out how much it's affecting the animal, because of course you want the animal to behave as naturally as possible. So it's really fun. I mean, it's really frustrating, but it's one of my favorite things about my job, that I just get stuck with a problem and all I have is some zip ties, some duct tape and a Mars bar, and I've got to figure it out.
Are there some animals that we just... that just remain behind the glass of mystery, that we cannot know about because they just travel to places we can't track them?
That's a great question. I think it's probably still mostly the insects, but also deep water species. We still really struggle to catch deep water animals and keep them healthy enough to be able to study them. So for instance, you could put a very deep fishing line down and catch a shark and bring it up from 3,000 meters depth, but it probably won't survive well enough to have a tag put on it. And we still don't know anything like enough about the deep ocean. So I think that might be where the new frontier could be.
What's the most surprising thing that's happened to you during your work? Because you, as you described it, it sounded quite exciting, the sort of marine biologist version of Indiana Jones, traveling to these far flown places and trying to wrestle down different animals. What's the most surprising thing that's happened?
Well, there's a clear winner for this one. So I've been tracking Atlantic bluefin tuna, which are these enormous great big tuna fish that we actually get all around the shores of United Kingdom now. So you'll find them off the shores of Ireland as well, especially in the late summertime. And one of our trackers came off and it washed up on a beach in France, and a French lady found it and she mailed it back to us. And so we get the tracker back and we plug it in. And the tracker's recording a couple of things: light levels, temperature, and depth. And for the last 2 weeks, while the tag was at sea on the tuna fish, it claimed that the sea surface temperature had got up to 37 degrees Celsius. And we were like, what? Like, what? How is there such hot water? And we were thinking, is there a power plant or something that's spat out some hot water? What's going on? But the tag also said it was dark for that whole period as well. And what we realized later was that actually a killer whale ate our bluefin tuna. And when I say ate, these bluefin tuna are well over 2 meters long. So this is like the best the dog ate my homework story ever. But a killer whale ate my research project.
Is that a good thing?
It's for the killer whale, less so for my poor tuna being tracked. It was fascinating, actually, because one of the things that came out of that was that the tag then got stuck in the killer whale's stomach for about 11 days. So my research group is now in possession of the world's longest killer whale track by some way. The next longest one is about 3 hours. So we now have a really good insight into killer whale biology as well. So that was kind of cool.
And I'm glad it came out as well, for the killer whale's sake. Can I ask one final question? You mentioned temperature, depth, and light was being measured. We can't measure GPS in those sort of situations, can we not?
No, we can't measure GPS underwater. The signals don't travel through the water, but that's actually why we measure light levels. And that's because the length of the day will tell you a little bit about latitude. So obviously we're all waking up in the mornings and it's getting a little bit brighter every morning right now. And so the length of the day tells you how far north you are. And then the time that the sun comes up will also tell you about your longitude. So the sun's coming up later in New York than it is, say, here in Ireland. So, so you can use light to work out roughly where an animal is too, which is pretty cool, eh?
I have a friend of mine who's a seismologist. I'm sure he would have some sort of seismograph that you could stick in there that would tell you something about where you were.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah. I must have a chat with them. Dr. Lucy Hawkes, thank you so much for joining us. That was absolutely fascinating. The Northern Ireland Science Festival is still going on. If you would like to know more, you can check out Northern Ireland Science Festival website. It is nisciencefestival.com. Some of their events include Exploring the Universe with space expert Maggie Adderin-Pocock and an anatomical workshop on respiration and deglutition, which is breathing and swallowing, on Tuesday. Find out more on nisciencefestival.com. Lucy, thank you so much. It's time to look back at some of your comments from last week, which you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or tweet us, we're @NewstalkScience. We were talking about toxic semen with Maciek Meselko. He's a guy who's managed to find a way to genetically engineer mosquitoes to have toxic semen so that they don't reproduce. We had a text in from Jerry. Says, genetic engineering of anything in nature is criminal. It's against all natural law. Are these idiots deliberately trying to create a virtual parody of the natural world or what? It should be illegal. Well, I mean, like, if you think about crossbreeding of animals or plants, you know, that's, we've been doing that for centuries. That's kind of the same thing, except a little bit of a low-tech version. But you're taking genes from one plant and putting them in another to, you know, to have bigger tomatoes or to have insect resistant crops. Like, this approach has been around for quite some time. I do sort of feel like when you're dealing with live animals, there is sort of a bigger question mark that should be put out there, particularly animals that can go through many generations very quickly. They breed and die. The life cycle is a short one, so very quickly they can change and adapt to different environments. But look, to be honest, anything that gets rid of mosquitoes that are killing millions of people from malaria is probably a good thing, in my guess. And it's only one specific type of mosquito, but I get the sense that the way they've designed it, there's no possibility of leakage. But then, you know, gotta take the word for it, don't you? That's it from us in this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.